kind of a little rant, but it's something that irritates me, that a lot of our engineering leadership, engineering management, culture, literature, all everything that was built over the last 5-10 years, it's been how to run one-on-ones, and nobody talks about the rest of what leadership is about. And this is the kind of stuff that I think is a strong component of leadership. It's like, think about your strategy, actually think about what you're trying to do.
Welcome to Developing Leadership, the podcast for engineering leaders, where Isel Kent and Jason Warner share their lessons on the ins and outs of managing software teams. Today, we have Phil Calzado on the podcast. Phil is the Global Chief of Technology Officer at PicPay, one of the largest engineering orgs in Latin America. He's had a front row seat in some of the most recognized engineering orgs built in the last decade. ThoughtWorks, SoundCloud, DigitalOcean, Meetup, SeatGeek. Heard of them? He joins us to retell the war stories from his wild journey as the guys discuss building alignment in large teams, developing good microservices architectures, designing languages for organizational effectiveness, and more. As always, this episode comes with accompanying show notes, with a deep dive into the main topics, mental models, and key moments from this episode. Find them at developingleadership.co and linked in the episode description.
Developing Leadership.
Hi, everyone. Welcome back to yet another episode of Developing Leadership. Jason and I have a special guest with us today, Phil Calzado, who is the Global Chief Technology Officer at PicPay. PicPay is today one of the largest engineering orgs in Latin with over 1,200 engineers. I know you're sitting in New York, Phil. For a lot of people who don't know PicPay, give a little bit of background and how you guys managed to end up being one of the leading engineering organizations in all of Latin America, and especially in Brazil.
Oh, sure. So I'm originally from Brazil, but I've been living abroad for 15 years now, and I'm been in New York for the last 6. And PicPay, one way to think about it is, I mean, considering more like the North American side, it's like Venmo here. It started off as a platform for people to provide peer-to-peer payments, a little bit like PayPal, kind of evolved. We have credit cards, we have loans, personal loans, we have like lending clubs, all sort of different investments. The easiest way to think about it really is it's like Venmo or PayPal, where it's the easiest way to pay for things. If you walk around Brazil and some of Latin America, you're going to see little QR codes for PicPay payment everywhere. So that's basically what we do.
I told you 5 minutes ago we were going to start off talking about OKRs, and we'll talk about OKRs. But I was again just going through your background, and you were at ThoughtWorks in 2007. You were at SoundCloud in 2011. You were at DigitalOcean in 2015. You were at Buoyant in 2017. WeWork in 2018. Meetup, in 2019. SeatGeek, you've had a front row seat to some of the most well-recognized companies and their engineering orgs that have been built for what is well over a decade and a half. Was that deliberate?
Yes, I only pick winners. So ThoughtWorks was, that was my dream job as a young engineer, to work with all the amazing folks that was there. And I guess after that, I've been lucky that I worked in some products that really had some traction and were able to execute a good technical strategy here and there. I think my Twitter bio says that I've managed teams for companies that make $200 million in revenue and have no users, or have 200 million users and no revenue. And that's basically, if you look at those companies, it kind of looks like that. And I just Meetup and WeWork were the same company when I was there. I was actually part of the plan when WeWork acquired Meetup. Nobody knew what to do. So shocking, WeWork didn't know what to do. So they hired a bunch of people like myself to help scale Meetup up. And then it's a very long story after that.
And you have this running threat, right, throughout all of it that I know you're probably tired of, which is microservices. And my goal today is to get to OKRs. But there's a pretty good line that we can probably go from microservices to organizational structure to OKRs. And I just kind of want to kick you off with that thought.
I think they are kind of related in a way. Oh. Maybe the easiest way to think of them as part of one system to me is that if you have a well-developed microservices architecture like we had at SoundCloud, DigitalOcean, and now at PicPay, one thing you probably have, or maybe even the reason you probably have that, is because you want your teams and business units or whatever you have to be very autonomous and to have freedom to go about and, you know, choose your own path towards something. But ultimately, it's very easy for you to end up with 10 different companies inside one, each little silo doing their own thing, probably sometimes even against each other. And this can get real complicated. And one tool that I like using a lot in aligning everybody is actually OKRs. We were joking just before that I don't fully understand how it got to a point where there's so much polemics around OKR. I think it's just because, you know, the Google toolkit is always being complicated to adopt in some companies. But one of the ways that I managed to tie up all these different teams working on different microservices, features, products, whatever they have, is with processes that try to bring some alignment, such as OKRs.
You said something I want to dig into a little bit more, the different companies within a company. And so before we get to, like, you know, alignment and OKRs, let's dig into some of the war stories. What are some of the situations you found yourself in or came across where the good intention of giving people the ability to, you know, move independently and autonomously ended up having the negative consequence or the negative outcome of that? And curious to just share with us what can happen if it goes wrong.
I think one interesting fresh example I might have is at PicPay right now. Well, when early in the year, say January, we found out that we had, I think, 4 different teams in 4 different business units that had their own version of a ledger, like what comes in and out of your account. And it's funny because PicPay is a reasonably old company. We're like about 10 years this year. Well, actually, we are 10 years this year. And that has never been a problem somehow until we created a feed that tells you all transactions happening in your multiple different accounts. So your credit card, your peer-to-peer lending, all this kind of stuff. And then somebody had to create another service that sits on top of all these services that actually aggregates all this information, tries to reconciliate them and work out timestamps and various different things and rules, trying to unify that in one single vision. And one thing we've detected is that we're missing some kind of, we keep calling it product platform, but I don't love the name, where, you know, this kind of more core service exists, where other features depend on it, but not every single feature needs to build their own version of a ledger. But then if you take maybe, I don't know, 10 steps back and look at 2 years ago when people start working on this, there was no ledger service and you need to build this feature. So what do? You just build one along with your feature, and then the next team is doing the same and the next team is doing the same. This lack of alignment, which has to do, there's a little bit of the OKR side of things. Another kind of tool I like using a lot more on the technical side is RFCs. I'm really passionate about a particular style of RFC that I've been using for years now. It's not about approval, it's about building alignment and visibility. If you're talking about 200 engineers, 1,200 engineers, there's no way people know what's happening in the company. It doesn't matter what level you're at, you don't know. And I think, especially as leaders, a lot of what we need to do is to promote this kind of conversation and dialogue, especially now everybody remote. So what kind of opportunities you have, being that on OKRs, RFCs, I don't think it's the kind of thing you should go for. A pull request review shouldn't be dealing with that necessarily, but this kind of higher level conversations, how you can promote them to build this alignment so you don't end up in a situation like I was talking about. We have 4 or 5 different systems that do exactly the same thing in different technologies. I forgot to mention that as well.
Yeah, I mean, Phil and I go back a ways. We had a couple of conversations a long time ago when I was at Heroku and stuff about some of these things. And one of the things that, you know, over the years, I saw you and I have talked about both OKRs and microservices and things of that nature. The bad pattern that emerges, remember, these are things, they serve us. They're neither good nor bad. It's the misapplication that leads to bad, or the proper application which leads to good. So it's like our misapplications of certain things could make things bad. And so when I think about microservices and services in general and the bad patterns that typically emerge, one is exactly what Phil is talking about. It's like, it's a social construct. It's like, hey, the company doesn't know what we're doing. We're going to end up with proliferation of these different things. Another is, you know, we had an experience at Canonical where one person wanted to put up their own service and they wrote it in Haskell. And it was not, we had an approved language list or whatever, but somebody went off track then. They wrote it in Haskell. They're the only person around who was using Haskell and knew it. And this was way back when Haskell was still kind of, it is niche now, but it was very niche you know, 8-10 years ago type of deal. And the person was on a plane and the service went down. Literally, like, had that experience. Person was on a plane, the service went down, and ended up in a really bad spot. But more than anything, like, I think what happens typically in organizations is, and why the RFC process or something like that is incredibly important, is just like in the market, companies do the exact same thing where you expand and then eventually you need to contract again. So you can expand and have a whole bunch of different services that pop up, but at some point you got to contract and like build another layer. It says, these are our services. This is our ledger service. We don't have four. We've got one or maybe two, but you know, then we're going to build upon these here at that point going forward. And it's really important because the RFC process helps understand where you are in that, saying, oh, no, we've already got a ledger over here. Do we need to generalize this? Because a lot more business units are going to have to start using this. We definitely don't need a fifth ledger service. Mm-hmm. That is for sure. So let's figure out where we are in this process.
Yeah, I think it's even first, I can't wait to see what kind of feedback this podcast is going to get after those comments on Haskell. It's going to be lovely. But one, I think that I would say that even 10 years after I left, the most kind of sophisticated advanced architectural work was at SoundCloud. And one of the things we had was kind of the vision for where we're going, even when we had no idea how long or if ever we're going to get there. And that's the kind of concept in primitives and in philosophies that we would codify. And it's interesting, the other day, a few weeks ago, I was actually reading SoundCloud's engineering blog written by somebody I have never met, and they're still referring to those terms. So that was super interesting to me to see how perennial they can be. And it's like 10 years after, they're still talking about, I think we used to call them value-added services, core services, whatever it was, it's still the lingo they use. And it kind of creates this kind of, I know, meta architecture to an extent. It's super important in making sure that there's some alignment there.
Oh man, I have so many questions that I'd love to go into Friday with you right now. Before we do that, because we're going to get the Haskell comments, you guys who are listening to this, you have a Haskell fan and one of the co-hosts. I always say that when I'm nice and rested and on holiday, I like to write Haskell. But when I need to get shit done, I write Go or Python or TypeScript or whatever.
You're not
it is.
Making it any better. It's going to be.
But I know that this. I was about to say, I know I'm making it worse. Well, I know I'm making it worse.
So here's the thing. I don't think you're an actual nerd unless you love an esoteric language for all of its beauty and warts that never should make it to production. Too.
Exactly.
We all have that language, right? Yeah.
I was about to say, I think the bar we can set for engineering and engineering leaders is like the moment you graduate to an effective senior have some seniority is when you have realized that your esoteric love, you know, should never, ever, ever make it into your organization, which will open us an interesting discussion one day for like designing languages for organizational effectiveness, like Go and others. Let's go there for a bit. Like,
this is a topic that I touch on all the time, actually on Twitter, because people give me a lot of crap for making fun of Java. And I have said for a long time, I said Java achieved two things. It was made to achieve mass market success in large organizations as a middle of the road average engineer language. And so it, by design, was not supposed to be a very, very sharp tool. It was by design supposed to be more of a generalized approach and all that sort of stuff. I don't like it. I don't like writing Java. It's like 90% ceremony and whatever. I just don't like it. But it is a great language to choose if you're one of those organizations that's massive and it makes it easy to choose. But like, I'm an Erlang dude. Like Phil just mentioned this one. I like Erlang. I like some esoteric language. I like the Lisp. I like Clojure. Like, you know, like that sort of stuff. But I'm not picking those things if I'm going to go start a company today. You know, I might pick a different esoteric, more mainstream language. Rust and Go's for the type of stuff that I would be building on and stuff like that, but at least they're more mainstream. But Java is a great example of this, in my opinion, because Java is a pretty shitty language. Let's just be honest with you. It's a bad language.
The amount of code you have to write to achieve the same thing and the amount of ceremony is so much more that I would even argue that it should never be put in place, even in those organizations where they're trying to have that middle layer. Like it's the only thing that we've done with Java is just taught a lot of people how to write Java so we can find a lot of people who know Java. Like
this would be where AI takes over, for what it's worth. AI will get rid of all that ceremony for us on the Java landscape and stuff. Anyway, like well, there's a billion people who are going to hate mail me at this point, but I'm okay with it.
Welcome to the Java Haters podcast.
No. you have to say something now. You got it. We can't have all the hate. Come on, Jason and I.
So the funny thing is that I actually, so I mean, we don't have video in the podcast, but there's like there's a bookshelf behind me. There's most books there about programming languages. I'm a big I was, I guess, it's been a while, big programming language nerd, and I actually like Java. I like it a lot. It's nice. It's fine. Gets stuff done. I've been doing a lot of Go over the last years, and it's not my favorite thing, but it also gets the job done, so it's fine. But one interesting thing, even kind of going back to thinking about leadership and strategy, was, again, back at SoundCloud, which was a little bit more interesting to me in terms of big decisions being made, because we didn't really have a lot of cloud infrastructure back then. Like, you guys had Heroku, which was great until you needed scale, and then you just like wasting all your VC paying your Heroku bill. We put our internal Heroku, of course, like everybody did. But then one thing that was interesting back then was we were in Europe, right? SoundCloud is still Berlin based. Back then, remote work was not a thing at all for most companies. And when I joined SoundCloud, I had 3 million people. That was October 2011. By the end of the year, we had 3 million monthly active users. By December, we had 10. The next mid of next year, we had 100. And when I left, we had about 400 million active users. And things would break all the time. I needed somebody as the leader of the product engineering organization. I needed to scale up those systems. It was getting to, you know, the fairway of Twitter. We had the cloud, that SoundCloud, that was basically the same thing. And a few things I've learned is that, first, you couldn't acquire that knowledge. There was nobody around me that I could easily hire that would know how to scale up systems. I didn't know. I spent most of my career up to that point in the enterprise world. And in Europe, it's fascinating because I could go, especially to Eastern Europe, and find people who'd be more than willing to move to Berlin, who had fantastic computer science backgrounds, but spent 5 years working on compilers. So the only systems they worked had like 5 users at the same time, maybe. And I was, one thing that I was lucky is I realized that Germans really like living in Germany for some reason. So I would find a lot of German people who had been living in the US for maybe 4 years, you know, Facebook, Google, convince them to move back to Germany and they would join us. But even those folks were interesting. And a lot, some of these folks even were the people who eventually created Prometheus, the telemetry system. But one interesting thing is that they would be coming from Google and Facebook and whatnot. So they never really saw those companies scaling up. They were there when the tooling and infrastructure was already there. So one thing that I think was really a good set of choices we've made is that we decided to pick one language, one stack, and industrialize it. We did run a few experiments and settled for Finagle from Twitter, which we were trying to use from Java back then, which was like the easiest language to get people to with experience to join the company. But Finagle is written in Scala. So it was after trying very hard to make these things work, like, okay, no, let's settle for Scala, but it's like programming C++. We're not going to use all of Scala. We're going to use like these 4 things. And that was very successful I think they still basically use the same technology. A lot of it just because Twitter engineering, and it's funny to be talking about Twitter engineering at this point in time, was excellent. Like Marius, the people behind the Finagle team were just incredible and so generous with their time and technology. That was the reason we were able to scale up SoundCloud with, you know, SoundCloud had, when I left, I think 200 engineers. Spotify, Apple Music, all these people had thousands of people. But the secret sauce we had was definitely being able to industrialize our use of programming languages, kind of consolidating 2 or 3, and lucky enough to use this toolkit that had been developed by a company much bigger than us, Twitter, and had everything we ever thought, well, we didn't even know we would need in terms of load balancing, scalability, all this stuff inside. So I think when it comes to technical strategy, which I think is an extremely important part of technical leadership, this was a great move we made. We made some bad moves, but this was a good one.
Yeah, I think that could touch on an entire podcast episode itself, which is, you know, how you approach your internal technical organization and almost like you want to say technical culture and how it evolves over time and stuff. And, you know, again, this is where kind of experience, all three of us on this podcast, but particularly Phil, you and I, given the global nature of our organizations that we've run, and from the technical side of the fence, matters, like nuance comes into this. So whenever you're talking on Twitter, you can say, don't do blah. Well, a lot of the companies in the world, it's never going to matter for because they're not that type of company. But like, if you're, you know, us, you know, SoundCloud or Heroku and GitHub and whatever, like they're very technical architectures and they have scale needs. A lot of companies don't have that sort of same scale need. And so it's a very different kind of nuanced conversation. So again, like I've told people on Twitter very publicly, I'm like, hey, just pick a monolith, a programming language, use Heroku or the equivalent and GitHub or the equivalent and like literally go about your day. Mm-hmm. Don't sit there and micro decide all these things. Cause you know, if you're a brand new CRM type of tool, it's likely not going to matter for quite some time until you figure out your customer go-to-market model and your customer acquisition and pricing strategy, et cetera, et cetera. Now, just yesterday I was talking to another company who's doing like ML pipelining. And they're like, I know you're not a big fan of microservices. I'm like, literally, you're the type of company where we can have this conversation because you're a very technical architecture that has a scale component and nuanced, you know, ups and downs and left and rights all over the place. Like that advice is for people who are a different type of company that's being built. You know, very large scale distributed system and architectures are different.
It's funny, Jason, because, you know, I've seen we've been having this conversation. The job was in an industry for so long. And I think 2022 puts another interesting dimension or open question to this whole thing, which is, to be honest, cost. Just the sheer cost of running a platform like that. This is something, I have like a draft of an article I've been writing along this, but when you build an architecture based on this kind of fully autonomous teams and all this kind of stuff, there's like the redundancy we've been talking about, and it's an expensive architecture, both in terms of people to keep it running and just cloud costs is massive. That was okay when VCs were telling us, I don't care how much you're spending, just like get as many people in as you can, then we'll figure out how to monetize this thing, which is the environment SoundCloud had back in the day. Nobody was telling us how to monetize for years and years, just like get people in. But if you're having to take this into consideration and thinking about, oh, this needs to be a business more than just, I don't know, this internet bubble kind of startup, it's another question to take into consideration when deciding for microservices, distributed architecture, whatever it is. And even day to day, like, should this be one system? Should it be two systems? What's the cost? One thing that we're trying to derive at PicPay right now, it's a little complicated because we have, you know, 10 years of systems built, is what's the fixed cost per service that we have, because we have things like licenses of, you know, security software that runs, for instance, monitoring. It's quite expensive and we don't know. So this is not something that I can give an engineer right now as they're making a decision. I don't want to make the decision for them. I want to give them all the possible data and say, look, is it better to have one service, 10 services, whatever it is? But they need this kind of information.
That's an interesting point too. And I know we even said we want to get to OKRs here in a second, but that's a really interesting point given you go forward. So like pricing models are going to matter, but pricing sometimes dictates what some weird knock-on effect choices. So for instance, if you're a five-year-old company and you chose X software to do something, but they have per node pricing and you're bound into this the way it's going to work, some people are going to make some architectural decisions based on the fact that they don't want to pay that vendor more money because it's already been an extreme cost. It's a weird thing that happens, but I've seen it all the time. You know, like especially when you get into you're already paying tens of millions of dollars for some of these vendors. And if you double your fleet size or something like that, then all of a sudden you're paying ridiculous amounts of money. So it's kind of interesting to see what non-first principle architectural thinking kind of goes into organizations at some point. And we as leaders always have to reroute it back saying, no, we'll F and rip that out if it's needed to be. Like, let's not have that discussion that we must do something because of a decision we made in the past. That's not how we want to run our companies. Yes, we might still make that same decision, but don't be bound in by that. Let's go back to how we're supposed to run our own business.
This one interesting thing that has happened to me is like, you know, I'm Brazilian. I left the country 15 years ago. I worked in the local industry for 5 years before leaving. But my career has been outside the country for all this time, most of the time. And now coming back, I know my intuition that doesn't work is that buy is often cheaper than build. Because the way that labor costs work in Brazil is different, especially if your revenue is in dollars, or if your bills are in dollars, which is a lot of our case. We use a lot of the vendors that everybody else uses around the world, but we pay their bill in dollar, which is like 5-1 for us. So way too often it's cheaper for me to get 5 of the amazing local talent we have put in a corner and say, I want you to run the open source version of this, like scale it up, the kind of stuff that I would never do in a company that's based in North America. but it actually makes a lot more sense in Brazil. And I think this can be also, even people who are working for companies in North America can play with this a little bit, especially now that remote is such a strong part of everybody's life. So maybe, you know, next time you're renegotiating your contract with your telemetry provider, which, let's be honest, that's 90% of where the money is right now. It's like data pipelines and telemetry is insane. Consider maybe, you know, if you get something like Prometheus and you get a few people in a different location that might not be your main location, what could you do? This is, you know, I keep saying that it's kind of a little rant, but it's something that irritates me that a lot of our engineering leadership, engineering management, culture, literature, everything that was built over the last 5-10 years, it's been how to run one-on-ones, and nobody talks about the rest of what leadership is about. And this is the kind of stuff that I think is a strong component of leadership. It's like, think about your strategy, actually think about what you're trying to do. And things change all the time. Like, this year has been crazy. The way it started, the way it's ending is like insane. How does that change your perception about how to build, buy, rent software?
So, Phil, I want to dig in here a bit, because you're opening up a door that can have lots of scary consequences.
Are we talking about Costco again?
No, we already got in trouble. We don't need to dig our that hole any deeper.
Exactly. We're gonna build a team somewhere, and they're gonna write, you know, a telemetry
they're
service.
They're gonna write a new Haskell, actually.
But they'll optimize the compiler first. So what's you know, we're in a world where if we play it out a little bit further down, you know, next 5 or 10 years, we can all probably agree that, you know, with the remote nature, salaries around the world are changing. Right, what we're seeing in, like, and I've seen this firsthand in Brazil, salaries have changed in the last 4 or 5 years because of remote, and vice versa. We're seeing this in the U.S. Like you're saying, hey, there might be more resources available to you that in a different location aren't going to be as expensive. So, given that things will unlikely ever to find West Coast salaries, you know, become the standard. But given that we'll probably equalize a little bit more than we already are. What is a rule of thumb here, right? Like, are we, because telemetry is a great example, right? Hey, we're spending X million a year, but if we do it, does it have to be a magnitude less before you start considering doing it yourself? Is it 50%? Like, where should we set the bar? Because I know there's probably engineering leaders listening to this running back and saying, guys, we should go build this inside internally. It'll save us 20%. Like, forget about maintenance, forget about everything else. And then we might have just unleashed an even worse thing than talking about Haskell.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think it's such a so many different dimensions to be taken into consideration and open questions. Maintenance is one of them, right? Like, how does that pan out? And one thing that it's funny, it's not about necessarily Brazil or kind of the global South, but I remember a few times in the US, I was either working for or helping companies as an advisor that would building a presence in Europe. And at some point you realize, you know, I have 4 people in Germany. I need a German office manager now. And somebody who understands how the market works and, you know, how to pay people, that kind of stuff. So the kind of added cost / overhead and building an organization like this is something that exists and needs to be taken into consideration. But I think ultimately, you know, having these open questions is a good thing. I'm more concerned, or the bit that hurts me the most is what I had built as this kind of intuition that was very absolute. It's like, no, I'll absolutely buy. Like, I was there when Prometheus was built. I had to wait 1.5 years for us to be able to use it as we've been developed. We were using StatsD. StatsD was saturated on network cards, was breaking every day. I was on call. I would be waking up at 3 a.m. to delete some files somewhere. And it took a while. And I keep saying that I wasn't happy back then because, you know, I wish we had the system there. I'm happy now as a user of Prometheus as open source technology, but the investment was massive. And even if you just get something that already exists and you keep running it, it is good. One thing that I think makes this kind of investments a little bit easier if it's because you can derive some kind of more discrete requirements for that. You don't need to be necessarily, it's not like product development. You can kind of basically have a spec and have a more isolated team building it. The integration is going to kill you if you don't do it right, though. And if you segregate these folks, especially if you're talking about a different geography, if I have my team in Rio building my monitoring system that never talks to my team in New York, good luck with that. It's never going to work. So that's a huge problem that way as well.
I've had this conversation a lot because I at every company I've ever worked at, and I've done this myself, this is where this actually started. At every company I've ever worked at, a new database was created. And I was, in my very first job, I created a new database. And I joke now with folks saying, like, at some point, some engineer is going to come to me and said, hey, to solve this problem, we need to create a brand new database. And my immediate pushback is, no, we're not going to create a new database for all the different reasons we're not going to. But you also at some point need to create a new database. Some companies do if you get to a certain size, scale, and scope. The point is, it should be your default to say, okay, we're going to go create this thing. There has to be, you have to actually do the work, the actual real engineering level work of saying, this is why we need to go do this. It's so critically important. It's principal to the way that we're going to scale or scope or whatever. But at some point, engineers like to build shit. And they like to build databases or languages or things of that nature. And so you have to be able to, as a leader, we have to be able to suss out whether or not it's a fun project or a needed project. And that is important. Because I wanted to create a database because I thought it was going to be better than whatever I was using at the time. And it was going to be fun.
Of course. Let's put some guardrails here. Like, right, like you mentioned your secret or special RFC process. You know, when... today at PicPay, you know, what does it need to look like for you to say, here we'll go build something or host and manage ourselves? Because I think you're almost introducing the third option, right? Host and manage ourselves, something open source. Like, what does that need to look like? And also for Jason to know, because once you start open sourcing some of this stuff, he's going to send them an email, write them a check to leave your company to go and turn it into a business. Like, that's...
So the RFC process, I actually have it well documented. It's on a blog post, and I have like an RFC on RFCs, which is
we'll post that. We'll link that here.
Yeah.
For all the listeners, just go to the Developing Leadership website, and we'll post it here for that.
But I think the main difference from the way I like to think about this process specifically from ways I've seen other places is that it's not so much about approval, permission, it's a change management kind of process. So I have a specific kind of template that I like, but it's very loose. It basically, you know, you state the problem, you state the solution, but to me, the most important part of the template itself is that you have the alternatives, like the things that, you know, you could be doing instead. And I engineers hate me for this, but the first one is, what happens if you don't do anything? And I get all sort of sassy comments on that one. It's like, I'm used to this at this point, but I really want to know. It's like, oh, so-and-so is going to break in 3 months. That's fine. We are going to run out of money. It's like, it's okay, but, you know, call it out. It's like, you know, you need to make sure that, well, I want everybody to know that, I want to know that everybody has been thinking about the consequences of things. So, from this, you know, this template, this like you circulate within across your engineering team. I'd like to create this kind of a timeline or a time box for comments. So, you know, between these 2 weeks, we're going to receive comments. The one thing I ask from anybody who has written an RFC, well, first, and then kind of also gets back again with some other components of the kind of engineering operating system is that the person writing the RFC, unless it's kind of a weird situation where the person who knows the most about the problem cannot be working on a problem, but oftentimes, or usually the person writing the RFC is accountable for it. So not only they are making the decisions, but they also, you know, responsible for what happens if this goes bad, if this goes good, that kind of stuff. So as a person who is accountable for that, I want this person to have the final say on what's going on. So they should receive as many requests and questions and whatever it is as comments. You know, usually using Google Docs is the easiest thing. My ask to them is to reply to every single comment they receive. They don't need to agree. They don't need to, you know, they could say that's a very good point, but, you know, we decided to go the other way. That's perfectly fine. But I want people who have spent time reading the document and making a comment to feel like they've been heard. And, you know, the comments and the feedback was taken into consideration, even if not necessarily went anywhere. And one thing that I think is the most important part of decision making in general, especially with engineers that I found over the last 10 years, is that it's, you know, this the whole thing about analysis paralysis and people disagree a lot. But if you have an impasse, if people cannot agree on something, And, you know, engineers can be very vocal and sometimes toxic around this. One thing that I've seen that helps a lot kind of break this tie and move forward is if you create a culture where you make a decision now and you know that this is going to be revisited in 6 months, 1 month, 2 months, whatever it is, that creates some kind of psychological safety or whatever it is. People are like, okay, I will disagree and commit. And in 6 months time, I'm going to come back to you and say, I told you so. That's fine. Just, yeah, tell me, I told you so, whatever it is, let's revisit, we discuss it, but let's move on with this instead of, you know, spending 6 months talking about this one little thing that we could build on that.
I saw this a lot in the Canonical Ubuntu organizations and cultures, because remember, we were Canonical was a for-profit entity, Ubuntu was the open source, so we co-mingled ecosystem and community and open source with the company and all that sort of stuff. But and I took it to heart as technical management, but then even executive management. And I think what you said here, like there's a thread all the way through this. And one of the RFC process I think is great. As an executive manager, what I've always said is I can't just make a proposal and say, we're going to go do this. I also have to have some follow-up with that. And I think similar to the RFC process is, hey, I'm putting this out there. Here's my comments. I'm going to respond. I'm then going to follow up with that and say, here's what we're going to do. Here's why. Here's the common objections, like thematically, here's some objections or worries or whatevers. And here's how we're going to handle that, whether it be we're going to mitigate it this way or we're going to watch for it. And if we're wrong, we're going to flip it and we're going to learn from it. But that actually is an incredibly important thing for executive managers. And I think like experienced ones will actually do that work. That is incredibly important work. And inexperienced ones think, I told the organization to go build this. They'll figure it out. And that is, to me, usually fraught with peril because it means that it's open-threaded. We don't know what to do or our guiding principles are going to be in that case. And on technical, I think we're more bound to help with that, like follow up a little bit. But it's important to institutionalize it. So I love the fact that you're doing that.
Yeah. And I mean, I use the RFC process for everything. Performance reviews, engineering levels, whatever, just like here's what's being discussed. And I think at the moment where you get the point where the organization understands it's part of the culture that this is going to be revisited in X amount of months, whatever it is, you can get things, and just like you can experiment a little bit more, which is probably the worst part of being a manager taking care of process and stuff like this. It's like, it's just, there's not a lot of room for experimentation. You know, it's people's lives often. But if they know that something's going to be revisited, there's a proper rollout process, you are able to, you have a little bit more leeway doing that.
I love this, by the way. And I think it again shows how, like, you know, your RFC process and literally the template that it's using, since you're using it everywhere, also becomes, as you improve that, you're globally improving it every time again, right? Like Jason was saying, hey, at some point we add the objection handling and like what we expect for the mitigations, that instantly, like, the organization's already used to it, you improve. But I want to close the loop on where we started, you know, 15 minutes ago, which is an RFC lands with you or another leader in the organization, and it says, hey, we're going to go build this ourselves instead of purchase Datadog, where I really hope you're not building. But you know what I mean? But like, we're going to go build this ourselves. At which point do you say, you know what, this argumentation is great, we should do so? Because that's it's a mindset shift that I see that you're having now with PicPay, but it's not obvious to a lot of people where to set those boundaries.
I think I think if everything goes well, this is a non-event, because, you know, the RFC goes through, is like, yeah, sure, of course. I mean, it's obvious, we understand what's going on. But then the amount of work you need to do during the process, as we've been discussing, like the actual discussion of the idea, RFC or whatever we might have, it's great, but also there's something before that, which is framing the problem well.
Yeah.
And I think this is where, especially now we're talking a lot about money, we're talking about money a little bit. I believe 2023 is when a lot of engineering leadership is going to go back to maybe the whole FinOps thing that we've been trying to make happen for years now will become a thing, because we will need to be talking more about money. The way I like to think about this is really kind of, the solution space is a large plane, and as a leader, you need to define boundaries on this plane and then let your team figure out within these boundaries what's the best. And you are not the right person to make these calls. You might be probably the right person to define where the boundaries are, you know, cannot cost more than this, cannot take more than this time, whatever it is, and let people play within that subspace, within the plane, what's the best idea. And you need to, and this is, I mean, I'm sure y'all had this conversation a lot in the podcast, which is, as somebody who is still very technical, I had to learn to let go. Because oftentimes, like, that's definitely not how I'll do any of this, but okay. And that's when the whole thing I was talking about, well, let's revisit this idea, works for me. Because then in 6 months, I'm sure these guys are going to, you know, hit a wall, and I know they will, but we're going to have to wait to have the conversation then, because I want them to have autonomy and ownership of what they're building.
The letting go part is actually one of the harder things I think leaders can do. And I've mitigated that personally by building an organization where I said, well, here's my concerns. And I try to define boundary condition concerns. Like, I would expect something like this to break. It's almost gotta be like a circuit breaker, like a big thing, like a massive thing. Say, like, as long as that sort of situational thing or condition or whatever is handled, like, go nuts, figure out the architecture, all that sort of stuff. I trust you all. And that part where the trust you all is a lot of where the actual building of companies comes in over the course of a couple of years. Because by the time I'm expecting similar type of thing, by the time an RFC hits my desk or I'm talking to somebody about something like this, it should have worked its way through various degrees of, like, let's call it like loosely mentored approach to like putting this idea together on paper. Like a very early in their career, junior engineer doesn't just put the RFC to like re-architect the entire system together without a senior engineer at some point looking into it to say like, yeah, no, that's not going to be how this is going to go down. Like, let's rescope this and stuff. So, like, that's part of the building up of the company, too.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's also, like, how the coaching aspect of this is very important. I've had cases where some junior engineer would be asked to write something. They end up with this thing that was, let's change the whole company, which was clearly never going to happen. And when the person, you know, when that hits the whole company and the way everybody reacts, sometimes worse than others, that one engineer is never going to write an RFC ever again because they don't want to go through that. So I think that's absolutely an important part of the process. And that's, you made me think of something else, Jason, which is that I like to think of two modes. And I am very explicit with people I work with directly about this, which is one is kind of the manager side, where I define the boundaries of the problem space. And it's like, this is a conversation we're having. These are the constraints for this problem. And I'm more than happy to take this hat out, put another hat, and we talk about, you know, let's spar on the solution. If you want to, because also, you know, I know that I can be nosy and I have a lot of opinions. If you don't want me there, that's fine. But I'm, you know, I've had some experience doing this kind of stuff, so I'm happy to join. But I really need to like shift my mindset completely. Otherwise, it gets really confusing.
We've talked about that particular point a lot on the podcast, but it's really worth reinforcing, which is any leader in general, but technical leaders in particular, need to be explicit about the role that they're playing. And so I do the exact same language. I walk into a room and I said, hey, I've got the product hat on at the moment. So here's my feedback to you. I've got the technical hat on. Here's my feedback to you. I'm an executive, generally speaking, at the company. Here's my feedback to you type of deal. That said, as a technical person, I have had to intentionally reduce the number of times I throw my technical hat on. Because there, no matter how many times I'm explicit about that, there's a weird power imbalance. There's Jason is sitting in the room with us having this conversation. And even if he makes a mild suggestion, somebody somewhere is going to think it's an edict. And I don't want that to be the case. I will let you know when I am telling you to do something. There will be no ambiguity over when I'm telling you to do something. But I've also realized that, like, it just is. So I have to do that less and less.
It's a good tool, but it's always hard. Also, it's so fun to be close to the problem.
That's the problem, right? It's like, and it's also like, I always said, like with the GitHub engineers, I always like to sit with them, particularly like the infrastructure engineers, because I'm an old infrastructure engineer. And you want to sit and you want to BS with them and talk about all this sort of stuff. And it's like all fun and everything like that. And then at some point you're like, I got to go back to work. Yeah. All right.
Exactly. Open spreadsheet.
This reminds me of, was it Mitchell at Hashi Corp, who just at some point decided to just, I'm just going to be an engineer again. Phil, we're nearing the end of our time, and I'd love to ask you one final question, kind of in line with where we just were, which was, you know, speaking up outside of what you're usually doing, right? No matter if that's in a room about an architecture decision, or if that's like sitting with a couple of engineers, it's this very powerful weapon that we should yield you know, very carefully in very specific situations, because even if we don't intend to, our words are going to carry more weight. What's one of the most notable times that you remember throughout your career where you were in that leadership position and said, okay, now I'm going to use it?
Oh, now I'm going to have to wear my...
Now I'm going to actually come and step in a situation where I really, you know,
yeah,
my voice shouldn't be there.
My voice shouldn't or should?
Well, that's the thing. If all was going well, it shouldn't. But like now, it absolutely needs to be.
Oh yeah.
Give us a war story to end today on. Yeah.
I think the one interesting aspect was my previous job before PicPay. I was at SeatGeek, which is like, you know, basically SeatGeek is number two to Ticketmaster in the US right now. And one of the reasons I kind of had to leave the company. I'm a big like live music nerd. Like I go to concerts every week. Love the domain, love the company. But I spent, you know, I was in the live events business when COVID hit. You can't imagine. I spent 2020 calling vendors and telling them that I wasn't going to pay the bills and we had to renegotiate what was going to happen. So when, you know, things started opening up a little more, end of 2020, we closed a few theaters in New York, like basically four or five Broadway theaters here in New York City, completely managed by SeatGeek right now, all the ticketing side. And we are going to have Bruce Springsteen doing his famous Broadway show once more after I don't know how many years. And that's like the hottest ticket on Broadway ever. And we knew it was going to be a nightmare to sell that. The problem is that we hadn't really sold a ticket in like 10 months. So our system was scaled down. We didn't even know exactly how to put things back up anymore because, you know, it was such a weird year. And that was the moment where I had to think about, you know, my moments when, I don't know, Lady Gaga dropped a new hot single on SoundCloud and everything would go to shit immediately. Like I had to wear my technical hat and work with a few people. There's a few presentations by the team who built the systems on this, which are great, on how to create all the different kind of bulkheads and throttling systems we needed. Because, you know, ticketing is funny. You have an inventory of 1,000 pieces and 100 million people. 100 million is too much, but you know, you got the number, trying to get those. So that was the one time where I had to sit down and kind of work very closely to the team, even writing code a little bit. So yeah, that's the war story more recently I can think of.
Oh, that's a fun one. Well, thank you so much for being with us here today, Phil. This was a lot of fun. I don't know if you feel the same way, Jason, but I feel like we haven't even scratched the surface.
No, we haven't. We got to have Phil back. We actually had to do the topic we talked about, OKRs, at some point.
Oh, yeah, true.
Sorry, everyone. We didn't get there, but we'll get there in another episode.
To create two other polemics, but not actually address one. Fair. I am all very happy to be here. More than happy to come back anytime. Just, you know, invite me and I'll be here.
Thank you so much. Fantastic. We'll do so.
Thank you for listening to Developing Leadership. Make sure you subscribe to follow us on our journey to more meaningful engineering leadership. If you have any challenges or topics you would like us to explore in an upcoming episode, tweet or DM us at devleadership_. To learn more about data-enabled engineering and how metrics can help your teams and improve your processes, go to athenian.com. See you in 2 weeks for another episode of Developing Leadership.